People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, wait a minute, wrong show, Black Clock Audio Tales, is part of Badger's Drift Studios, and sponsored by BunnySlippers.com. Check out their handy-dandy, nifty-swifty dinosaur slippers. They make sounds when you walk around. One of my friends, her son, got some for Christmas. His aunt bought them for him. From BunnySlippers.com, and oh boy, can we tell when he's walking around in his dinosaur suit with dinosaur slippers. It completes his outfit, and it's like, step, 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 roar! Step, 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 roar! It's not that much, and sometimes he just sits on the couch and hits his hands together till they go, roar! But I'll tell you what, I get irritated by stuff pretty quickly, and I thought, that sounds kind of irritating. Guess what? It's not. It's barely noticeable. If you're wearing it, you get it. If other people, you know, you have to be pretty close to hear it. So if you're worried about that, that sounds annoying. A dinosaur roar every 3 steps? I tell you, it's not. It's pretty funny. And also, get them for your kids. So you can tell when they're up and moving in the morning. They don't think about that stuff. They're just happy to be making noises and going to watch cartoons and eating cereal. They won't know that they're pretty much giving away their position if they're trying to, like, sneak into stuff. Kids aren't that smart. Do you know who's smart, though? Cody Goodfellow, who's going to be on the show talking about cannibalism, were-sharks, and all kinds of good stuff. So stay tuned for Black Clock Audio Tales. I'm DB Spitzer, and I'll be here all week long. And hey, we're almost done with Hawaiian folklore. You know what's up next? You know what's up next? You know what's up next? I'll tell you. It's a story written by a lady about a guy and a guy. Yeah, it's that story. It's Frankenstein in your face. I'm going to see how many people I can get to talk to us about Frankenstein throughout it. And I know a lot of people who can talk about Frankenstein. The movie, the movies, the books, Mary Shelley, gothic horror, all that fun stuff. I'll see if I can get some people who we've heard in the past talking about Frankenstein and see if we can find some new people. All right, and also, if you may have noticed, we have better sound equipment now, and that is because of your donations. Do you know people who donate to the show get stuff? Would you like to, donate $1 or $5, become part of our patron plan? Maybe talk to me about getting stickers, t-shirts, whatnot. It's cool. It's cool. Yeah, I think you'll like it. And also, if people start donating money to this and to the others, I'm going to put out projects, art projects, books and stuff like that. And you're going to get heads up and first grabs at stuff. So, hey, keep listening. There's, you know, if enough people donate, I'll start making coloring books, and people who donate will get coloring books of, I don't know, horror authors or, space monsters, stuff like that. So this stuff's all in the works, and it's just kind of like, hey, you help out, you get stuff. All right, let's talk to Cody Goodfellow about some were-sharks and cannibalism. All right, here we go. And also, later this month, we will have Cody Goodfellow talking about Shoggoths on People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. All right, back to the show.
So this is Black Clock Audio Tales Supplemental Hawaiian Folklore and Legends with author, writer, all-around awesome person, Cody Goodfellow.
Hey, how you doing? So I'm not a cultural anthropologist. I'm only a semi-literate tourist, but on a series of visits to Hawaii, came across the legend of Nanawe, the shark man of Maui.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, it's not one of those legends that they recount at luau's or put into tourist guidebooks. It was kind of this weird suppressed shadow folklore. And being as I was fascinated by the duality of Hawaiian culture that was totally suppressed in the Western imagination. We're conditioned to think of them as these happy-go-lucky, childlike people who are eager to share their paradise with you. so that you can turn it into a golf course and shit it everywhere. And of course, any diligent examination of their history will reveal that there's a lot more to it. Their history and their culture before the missionaries came is far more savage and brutal than what we think, but also far more complex. And I was drawn to the myth of Nanawe because it's a folk tale with everything that you'd look for in Bullfinch's mythology. It's gods coupling with mortal women and tragic destiny, and but it also has this specificity of a true crime anecdote, and it felt like something real. It felt like something that had acquired this mythic mantle in order to explain a human act that was otherwise unthinkable. And this led me to explore the concept of, well, the practice of cannibalism and ritual sacrifice in Hawaii. And the Hawaiian people will assert, and anthropological evidence bears out, that there was no history of culturally accepted cannibalism in the Hawaiian Islands. But while human beings were forbade to eat human flesh, the gods never got enough of it and were constantly ravening for it, and thus priests were constantly having to look for excuses to sacrifice human beings to the gods. And you think of Hawaii as this beautiful carefree paradise where everything was ready at hand, and yet I guess it's human nature to find some way to screw all of that up. The traditional Polynesian people, or traditional Polynesian culture, is laden with kapu, many of which are for people's safety or for the long-term preservation of the society, but many of which were seemingly very fickle and arbitrary and seemed geared towards punishing people in order to feed the gods. Of course, cannibalism itself was kapu and seen as repugnant in the eyes of the people and in the eyes of the god Kane, but the god Ku, the god of war, demanded human sacrifice in times of famine, in times of war, or to stab off times of famine or war. Human beings would be sacrificed. When a chief wanted a new canoe, it was not unheard of for a sacrifice to be made at the foot of the tree that was going to make the canoe. And on the day that the canoe was finished, and at other points in the canoe's construction, it was not unheard of to sacrifice a human being at each corner of a new house. So the relationship between seeing human beings as human beings, which is the most vital, fundamental point of the social contract. You know, in any society where you can look at the people down the road as food, it's not going to last very long as a society. And I think accounts of cannibalism in the South Seas are often either straight up blood libel or a misunderstanding by Western missionaries and explorers. Of course, the touchstone of this was the death of Captain Cook. Of course, Captain Cook died during a conflict. It was a very, very volatile situation where the first contact with Europeans, and he was killed, and his body was rendered as a sacrifice to the gods. And there's an account of a two Polynesian natives who came to the ship and apologized for the death of Orono, as they called Captain Cook, and they presented the horrified men on his ship with 9 pounds of his flesh, which they had retrieved as a goodwill gesture. His bones were apparently scraped clean, and all of his flesh was burned. In some accounts, his intestines were accidentally eaten by several children. You know, that's a likely enough misunderstanding. Herman Melville, in his book Typee, has a lot of fun with an old man who claims to have eaten one of the toes of Captain Cook. And you know, this is the white European imagination playing with the idea of the noble savage having renounced cannibalism and yet kind of returning to it like sneaking a cigarette. But there are an abundance of stories that I think are there to reinforce the kapu against cannibalism, but also that was weird. Anyway.
Oh, what's up? Oh.
Yeah. And the tape failed.
Haunted basement.
These stories themselves have become kind of erased from the body of Hawaiian folklore, I think because the very problematic and complex nature feeds into this lurid white imagination of Polynesians as cannibals. But you take a story like the story of Kali'i Aikanaka, Chief Maneater, who's kind of an ogre character. It's fascinating how there's kind of deflection and misdirection to create these characters who were always other coming into Hawaii and bringing this horrible act, and yet its seduction is readily apparent in the stories. While ordinary people never consumed human flesh, it wasn't unheard of for warriors upon vanquishing an opponent to remove the heart and actually eat it. This is probably something, you know, one asshole did once, and it was so metal that it gets talked about, and it's kind of seeped into white colonial consciousness. But Kali'i Aikanaka was a warrior chieftain where he came from isn't clear, but it's always someplace else. Possibly Tahiti, he first appears on the island of Kauai, and he's a champion wrestler and boxer and a great warrior, but somewhere he picked up the taste for human flesh, and he was driven from his own home, he's driven from Kauai, and he settles on Oahu with a group of followers, they're of course soon reviled and despised because they pick fights and they kill and eat their victims and eventually it routed them out. It's a story that has a lot of resonance with the story of Sawney Bean, you know, in Scotland.
Yeah,
the 16th century highwayman cannibal. He was said to have existed somewhere in the 18th century. And there's a whole body of chief man-eater stories that were kind of, you know, straight up invented to scare children. You know, more complex and tragic is the story of Oahu Nui, who was supposedly a king on Oahu, although he is not mentioned in any of the official genealogies. Of course, if you had a cannibal in your family tree, you'd probably be forgiven for lopping that branch out too. But Oahu Nui was the last king who occupied the royal quarters at Oahu Nui in central Oahu. And he was seduced or tricked into consuming human flesh by another tribe of cannibal warriors who were also called the Aikanakas or man-eaters. And he developed a taste for it and murdered and cooked and ate his two nephews. And in the legend, his brother returned to the royal house and found the skulls cleaned and hanging out in front of the porch. And he came inside and found Oahu Nui drunk on human flesh and awa, which is a fermented beverage.
Oh, I know awa. Okay.
But do you know long pig?
Oh, no.
They're two great tastes. They go great together.
That's what I hear.
Yeah, so he beheaded Oahu Nui and left his body on in that spot, and the entire household became kapu, and the royal seat was relocated to Waikiki thereafter. It's fascinating that cannibalism, it comes up in these stories again and again as something that is forbidden and makes the man into something other, and yet it's something that's so seductive, and you wonder if it isn't forbidden. I mean, it's forbidden for the same reason, you know, opening an umbrella indoors is forbidden. Somebody's going to lose an eye.
Yeah.
But also because it belongs to the gods. I mean, if in Polynesian culture, if your shadow fell across the shadow of the chief, you're going on the block. If you eat the wrong fish, you're going on the block. If a woman eats lobster, or if a woman eats coconut, or if anybody's sitting in a canoe on the wrong day, you're going on the block. And, you know, human sacrifice was introduced, like a lot of things, to Hawaii from Tahiti. They trace it to one specific priest who brought the practice, and, you know, basically the gods are hungry. Some anthropologists point to each of the canon of Hawaiian gods: Ku, Kanaloa, Kane, and Tanaloa. One whose name escapes me. But as possibly men, as priests who came from Tahiti and thus acquired the mantle of gods. Which brings us to Nanawe. Nanawe's legend is, as I said, one that blends historical fact and purist folkloric legend. According to legend, Kamohu Ali'i, the king of all sharks, was so smitten by the beauty of a woman named Kale that he assumed human form and mixed with the people of Waipio Valley on the Big Island, and taught them some things like how to surf and plant taro root. But he seduced Kale and gave her a son. On the eve of the boy's birth, without telling her his true origins, he told her, "Well, my work is done here. I'm leaving. Don't ever let him eat meat. You'll find out why." And he disappears. And Kale gave birth to a beautiful son, whom she named Nanawe, who was perfect in every way except for the gaping, razor-fanged, lying mouth on his back. She obeyed the kapu against feeding him meat and let him swim by himself in another lagoon, where he became a shark whenever he entered the water. And everything went well until he reached of an age when he was taken to the longhouse to eat with the men. And right? And she had no control over it, so he ate meat and soon discovered that A, he really loved meat, and B, he was surrounded by meat. Nanawe took to swimming in the ocean and devouring his fellow villagers. People kept disappearing whenever they went into the ocean, and the only one who ever came back was Nanawe, who kept to himself and wore a mantle of tapa cloth over his back at all times. Once a nosy person ripped the tapa cloth off of his back, revealing this huge gaping mouth, and the people tried to seize him, but he threw himself into a river and assumed his shark form and swam away to the island of Maui, where he ingratiated himself with the Ali'i's family in the village of Hana, and found himself at the peak of the society, and he was a very handsome, athletically gifted man, a very strong swimmer, who would often challenge people to swimming contests, but nobody who lost a swimming competition to Nanawe ever came back. And Nanawe's appetite grew and his audacity grew until such point as he seized a girl in human form, carried her into the ocean, changed an aider in full view of the rest of the village. They tried to get him, but he escaped again, this time to Molokai. And married the most beautiful woman in the village, and was the toast of Molokai society until the priests there heard from the priests at Hana the truth about him, and put that together with the rash of disappearances. And so they watched Nanhali, and when they saw him transform, they caught him in a net, dragged him out of the ocean, and chopped up his body. His body, his shark form, was so full of fluid that they couldn't keep a fire burning underneath him to destroy him. Reading between the lines of the legend, it sounds as if even dismembered, he was still alive and possibly in danger of growing back together. And the priests and the people of Molokai had to denude all of the forests on the island in order to build a bonfire large enough to destroy his remains. And thus perished Nanhali, the shark king, shark man of Hana.
Huh.
And you can find online and in some of the folklore books, it's a lesser known myth. There's an album called The Shark Man of Hana. You can do an image search and find the lurid cover art. Sadly, nobody's ever digitized it or put it up on YouTube. There's no report of its accounts or of its contents. But just look at the art. I have to imagine it's one bitchin' album. Nanhali is the most prominent shark man, but not the only one. I found one account of a similar case named Kewalo. And Kewalo was a humble hermit who lived outside his village down near the shore. And he would ask anyone who was going fishing, you know, where they were headed to fish or swim. And he would invariably warn them, be careful, a shark might eat you. And then he would follow them, and he would turn into a shark, and he would eat them out in the ocean. And he did this a number of times until he was caught, and the priest killed him. And this story has none of the symbolism or frippery or divine intervention that Nanhali's story does. But again, it feels like a story, kind of like the stories of, like, Peter Curtin, the Vampire of Dusseldorf, you know, medieval accounts of werewolves.
Yeah.
Probably savage men that acquired a taste for human flesh. And it's weird the persistence of these stories at the back end of this folklore, because our very, you know, Manichaean, very, very simple understanding of or forbiddance against this kind of thing, but also our very, you know, equally lurid interest in it. Of course, I you know, when you write horror stories, you're capitalizing on somebody's misfortune. It's understandable why these things are buried, not really a centerpiece of their folklore traditions, because they're not always freaking fascinating. But I would love to have a conversation with a local folklorist about local as in Polynesian, about these stories and why they aren't more widely known. And I think because it's troubling, and it's also a reminder of of a time that's shameful and weird. I mean, the real threat and the real horror wasn't really isolated nuts like Kewalo or Nanhali or even Kalei Kanaka, who practiced cannibalism, you know, in warfare or because they were Stone Age serial killers, but evil bastards like Pau, who brought the practice of human sacrifice and made it something institutional. That's what's really terrifying. The human beings can be driven by extremity to eat human flesh, but when the gods are hungry, you know, who's to say when they're satisfied? That's about all I got.
Hey, no problem. Just something I wanted to point out is, mm-hmm. or something I wanted to say is that mm-hmm. The cannibalism and like it being an other as opposed to you, and so it's not us. It's mm-hmm. this otherness.
Mm-hmm.
Really reminds me of Wendigos.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Nanawi is kind of like a Wendigo. It's a, you know, that Athabaskan thing. What I loved about the story of the Wendigo is that you can become one by eating human flesh or by becoming lost in the woods.
Yeah.
I love that those two were equally, they're put on the same scale with the same weight and as their value in their culture.
Two great tastes that taste great together.
Right. You can look at the koala myth as a cautionary tale. The moral of which is never tell anybody where you're going fishing. I think because of an examination of you look at folk tales as some are a description of, you know, this is who we are, and they're laid alongside this is who we are not. And there's always a need psychologically to define the ones that we are not as something other. You know, they turn into a wolf by the light of the moon, and they can turn into a shark when they go into the ocean. That's the fascinating question. But this is also the culture that gave us the notion that you could gain somebody's courage by eating their heart. So does it make you another, or does it make you quintessentially what you are? I don't know, but I look at the news and I have to think one way or another. We won't have long to find out. You know, I mean, when they reboot Soylent Green, Will Smith's going to yell, "Yeah, Soylent Green's only like 20% people." Well, so I'll give you a plug. You can find out more about Nanawe and ritual cannibalism in Hawaii in my book, Repo Shark.
Nice.
Available from Broken River Books.
Cool. Any other books on cannibalism?
No, not yet. I mean, cannibalism is like lurid and icky, but human sacrifice is a lot more fascinating.
Sure.
There's a great book on it called The Highest Altar. It's a survey of human sacrificial practices. It focuses a lot on South America, but it's a great resource for further reading.
Nice.
Yeah, has some wonderful recipes. But yeah, if you're going to be cooking human flesh, use a banana glaze and wrap it in taro leaves.
Good to know.
A luau style earth cooker. And if you stuff the emptied out carcass with hot rocks, it'll cook thoroughly and evenly throughout.
Good to know. Mm-hmm. Good to know.
I mean, gosh, I you know, you have that, I mean, when you have that, when it's really borne in upon you, yeah, animals, you know, they're related to us. When you see pigs in a tent, you look at individual parts of them, and that they're just naked little guys.
Yeah.
And I guess some people that causes them to rethink their diet, and some people not. I mean, that's the question, isn't it? I mean, if you're pushed to it by extremity. I've written a few stories using, you know, Lovecraft's ghouls that play around with the concept of eating human flesh and what, you know, what this forbidden sacrament what, you know, why is it forbidden? Is it forbidden because it's simply a loathsome practice and the death of society, or is it because it gives you something? You know, the film Ravenous played with that wonderfully. There's a really terrible pseudoscience book called the Beginning Was the End, by this total quack Bavarian anthropologist, about how ritual cannibalism amongst Stone Age proto-humans was what led to human beings become sentient. And so he argues that sentience itself was the horrible bargain that we struck when we first ate human flesh. It's a hilariously awful notion, but I wrote a story which should be appearing in a book, I believe called Tales from Arkham Asylum, edited by Brian Sammons, coming out someday. But there's a small coven of girls going to Miskatonic University in the 60s, and in pursuing lots of witchy anthropology things, they're exploring a notion that the Eleusinian Mysteries might be a cannibal cult. The Eleusinian sacrament, it's one of those things kind of like Soma. There's endless speculation about what it was that they were actually consuming there that was the secret. I postulate that the secret of the Eleusinian Mysteries is that knowledge can be conveyed by eating brains. And so if they're passing on this sacred knowledge by consuming ritually the brains of all past members, and thus they're preserving knowledge even in the face of all the books being burned, all the lights going out. And so you have the potential to know everything, but of course there's a terrible cost. I like to think there's a really good reason that we're not allowed to eat human brains, aside from, the obvious. Like I said, be excited to find out someday. Cheers.
Yes, no, I've joked, people are like, oh, you're allergic to everything. You can't have dairy and you can't have eggs. What are you going to do when society fails? And I'm like, well, huh. Probably eat people like the rest of you.
Right? Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the, I wrote a story that's coming out of Pizza Anthology pretty soon. And I won't go into too many details because I don't want to ruin it, because Lord knows who won't want to read a whole book of pizza horror stories. It's called The Vegan Wendigo. I can't stop picking it at any ironclad ethos. And so the notion of veganism, it seemed like, well, okay, you're not allowed to eat meat, but why? Because it's non-consensual. You, by the same argument, you can't eat honey because you're robbing the bees. But what if the animal does give you consent? What if the animal could give you informed consent to consume its flesh? You finally found a solution to the hippie problem. I can't remember the name of the pizza anthology, but pizza anthology.
Look for it out there, pizza anthology.
Yep. All right. Enjoy your long pork, folks.
Thank you again, Cody.
Thank you, DB. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Always. All right. Thank you again for listening to Supplemental Number 4 with Cody Goodfellow, Cannibalism.
Hey, everybody. DB back again. Thanks again for listening to Supplemental 4 about were-sharks and cannibalism. We might reference this one again and might have Cody on. Well, we'll definitely have Cody on in the future to talk about all kinds of weird stuff, because being a weird fiction writer, that's something that you have to deal with in stock and trade. And if you've ever met Cody Goodfellow, well, he's well stocked in the weird. All right. Hey, would you like to be on the show sometime? Not this show. I've got another show. It's called Welcome to Portland. Are you going to be in the Portland area through Airbnb? Go to their experiences and look for, be on a Portland podcast, or you can go to PGTTCM, click on the link to Welcome to Portland, click on the Airbnb, and book. It's the best way I can book people on the show if they're coming into town. You get drinks, you get food. I make sure that everyone's well taken care of. You tell your story, and this is for Welcome to Portland, where people tell a story like whatever story you like to tell at parties, whatever story you like to tell. You know, it's like your personal story, that thing that happened to you. Nothing gory, no hate-filled speech. I don't like that stuff. And also, I want to hear your stories. I don't want people to send me stories. I don't want people to phone me. You have to be in the studio for this. And, you know, I'll let experts call in. Are you an expert? You want to talk about Frankenstein? You want to talk about Beowulf? You want to talk about anything we got coming up in the next few months? Feel free. If you, you know, Cthulhu writer, Cthulhu book person, if you're someone who wants to read a book for me, hey, contact me, pgttcm.com, and just track me down. Also, Facebook. Look for Black Clock Audio Tales and PGTTCM, People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, and Welcome to Portland on the Facebook and Instagram. We are Black Clock Audio Tales still. So, what are you waiting for? All right. Thanks again. Music by Kevin MacLeod. And oh, hey, speaking of music, music might change up a little bit here. Someone I know is getting a hurdy-gurdy. That person may be me. And also, I recently restrung a mandolin to be played like a ukulele. So, hey, who knows what could happen? But more than likely, it'll continue being music from Kevin MacLeod because I'm not a musician. All right, we're what? Ooh, that's 37 minutes, right about in about 5 seconds. Okay. Thank you again for listening to Black Clock Audio Tales. And thank you again. You can go to our Patreon button on pgttcm.podbean.com to donate some money or be part of the program. You want to get one of those coloring books? You want to find out about where we're going to be? Pins, badges, buttons, that kind of stuff? Become a patron. It'll all become clear. All right. I love you.